Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. That's imagine.dh.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The state's drug abuse crisis continues unabated, claiming well over 200 lives just since January. Meanwhile, more political leaders have been weighing in, including presidential candidates, lamenting the toll on families and communities and offering some solutions. Also earlier this month, Governor Hassan called upon lawmakers to craft emergency legislation addressing the opioid crisis. They opted instead to form a task force to review a range of options that include expanding drug courts and toughening penalties for the distribution of fentanyl, a synthetic opioid involved in many overdose deaths. So now, in the next 4 weeks, this group of 26 lawmakers will be working on these and other ideas, some of which have broad support and some of which could be more contentious. The hope is to have a package of legislation ready for late January. Today in The Exchange, a new task force tackles drug abuse. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, email exchange@nhpr.org, find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have four guests in studio, including two members of the task force. They are Jeb Bradley, Senate Majority Leader and Republican from Wolfboro. Senator Bradley, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Laura. How are you?
Also with us, Cindy Rosenwald, Democratic State Representative from Nashua, the Deputy Democratic Leader, and as I said, also a member of the task force, along with Senator Bradley. Representative Rosenwald, good to see you. Thank you for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us, Tim Rourke, Chair of the Governor's Commission on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Prevention, Treatment, and Recovery. Tim is also Director of Substance Use Disorders Grant Making for the New Hampshire Charitable Foundation. And Tim, welcome back. Thank you for being here.
Good morning, Laura. Thanks for having me.
And also with us, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. He's been covering a lot of this discussion at the State House. Gary, thanks for taking time out. We appreciate it.
Good to be here, Laura. Thank you.
Well, all of you, a big issue and lots to talk about, and I very much appreciate you being here. But before we talk about what this task force will do, there was some talk in the legislature, some members, who thought a task force was kind of kicking the can down the road on an issue that is too critical to do that. And Tim Rourke, I'll go to you first. How do you feel about that?
You know, I think that there is a real need to move both quickly and correctly. And I think the conversation that we saw that led to the formation of this task force, I think, underscores that. There are a number of things that the state of New Hampshire needs to do in order to effectively address this epidemic. And so I think the opportunity to dive into some of those issues, understand some of them and their implications, to make informed decisions with the legislature, and to expedite the decision-making process once the general court reconvenes in January, I think is the right step for us to ensure that when we get out of the gate with some of these community changes, that we don't see unintended consequences on the ground. I think everybody, certainly us at this table, as well as colleagues that I talk to and hear, communities are waiting and have been waiting for a long time and have been asking, when is help coming? I certainly think that this is a step in answering that question. And so I think a lot of us in the substance abuse community are really looking forward to engaging with this task force and really diving into some solutions they can bring forward over the next 6 weeks.
Well, and I want to get everybody's thoughts on that. But Tim, just real quick, remind us how we got here so fast. I mean, looking at some of the numbers yesterday, you know, more than 300 people dead last year, more than 200 already this year, and the year's not out yet. It's just stunning that this has very quickly emerged as the number one public health issue on people's minds in New Hampshire.
It is. And understanding that, you know, it's underscored by a lengthy history of us having high rates of substance abuse in our state. But what has happened over the last 5 years is we have begun to see a particular class of drugs, these opiates, move into the community in such a way they are highly, highly addictive. Drugs like heroin and fentanyl, obviously the use of them is incredibly unsafe and can lead to almost immediate death. So I think we have had a lengthy history of high drug abuse rates in our state. And then as the drug of choice has moved, unfortunately, into the opiate epidemic, given both their addictive nature and their risk in terms of use, I think it's led to this perfect storm where we've started to see this over, you know, 3 years, this huge spike in overdose deaths. And it really being remembering the tip of the iceberg around those that are impacted by addiction, both with opiates, heroin, fentanyl, over abuse of prescription drugs, as well as alcohol and other drugs that continue to be a problem in our state.
Well, and it's, again, a critical problem. And Gary Reno, I wonder what you heard at the State House, people saying, you know, this is terrible, and a task force, you know, really, that's the best we can do?
Well, I mean, it's certainly kind of a political football the way it was going back and forth. I mean, we had been hearing talk about a task force for quite some time, actually, since about the time the veto session was held. And it was going back and forth. And it finally, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, Senator Bradley and others had a press conference scheduled. And that morning, the governor went down to, I think it was Londonderry or Merrimack, at a Chamber of Commerce and laid out her proposal. And since that time, we've been sort of going back and forth. Senate President and the House Speaker really weren't willing to bring everybody back. And so she went to the Executive Council and got the vote there to call the special session. And when the special session got called and she put out her proposal, the bill that she wanted to be dealt with during the special session, the Republican leadership comes back with a task force. And it's sort of been kind of tennis, if you will, political tennis back and forth. And perhaps, I mean, I think there are a lot of people who think it's probably not the issue to be playing political tennis with, but we've been playing politics with this for quite some time.
Senator Bradley, what's your thoughts here? Again, some people said, Republicans and Democrats said that this was kicking the can down the road, and it's too important to do that.
Well, look, there's no question this is the public health crisis in the state of New Hampshire. We all know somebody or a family or a loved one that has struggled with addiction. We've done a lot over the years. I mean, Representative Rosenwald and I were sponsors of the prescription drug monitoring program several years ago that's being implemented, and without Cindy's support, it wouldn't have happened in the House. So we have responded, and I think as Tim said before, we want to both be expeditious but also careful and do it right. And so this legislative proposals, they're complicated. They need to be debated in a public forum with public hearings to make sure we get it right. We will, as the task force, I think, over the next few weeks, vet the proposals from the governor and others so that when January comes around, we're ready to go with a public hearing and early action on the floor. And I think that a lot of the things that we'll have a chance to talk about on this show this morning, we will move forward with. But I think it's also important to know that just like prescription monitoring that Representative Rosenwald and I worked on several years ago, this budget included a 75% increase in funding for substance abuse. Some of that went to the governor's commission that Tim chairs. We also passed greater availability of Narcan, which it's unfortunate that Narcan has to be used so much, but it is saving lives, and we're making that more available.
That's the overdose death drug.
Yeah, it counteracts the impact of heroin. And lastly, the Good Samaritan law. So if, you know, somebody is in the middle of a overdose situation and actually committing a crime at the same time, they won't be charged with that if they help save a life. So we have responded. There's obviously more to do, but I think you will see an awful lot coming out of the legislature early in January.
So those laws are already on the books. You're saying those are examples, Senator Bradley, of things that you guys have done already.
Right. And the big thing, I think, was the increase in funding for substance abuse issues. We've recognized it's a problem, and I think we're dealing with it. But it's a continuum, too, because it, You know, there's no one single thing that is going to cure this, but there's a lot of different strategies that have to come together. And it's, unfortunately, it took a while to get into the problem that we are in. It's going to take a while to get out.
Well, and I'm real interested to hear about some of the proposals that this task force is going to be looking at. We can dig into some of the issues. But Representative Rosenwald, first, your thoughts on, you know, task force, moving quickly, waiting till January. I'd love to hear from you on that as well.
Well, everyone else has said this is a complex, multifaceted problem. It's going to require a lot of solutions. Our challenge is complexity versus speed. And some of the work we have to do is less complex. We can move faster. Some of it is probably more multifaceted and is going to require a little bit more digging. But I think the most important tool we have is the successful Medicaid expansion. That's our biggest treatment funding source for drug addiction. And we simply have to move quickly to reauthorize it.
Well, and my next question for all of you was going to be, so I'll start with you, Representative Rosenwald. What do you think is the most important piece? If you could pull out one, the most important piece of the work before this task force, what will really make a difference with this problem? What do you think?
Well, we're losing basically one person in New Hampshire every single day to a drug overdose.
That's just stunning to me.
Nashua last month had 5 fatalities during the month of October, with more than one overdose every single day. So I think that increasing the penalties for dealing in fentanyl, and it's not the prescription fentanyl, it's not the patch, it's not the lollipop, it's not the IV liquid, it's this lab-created synthetic fentanyl, is probably the easiest step we can take quickly to prevent more deaths.
Let me also ask everybody that same question, but also invite our listeners to join us. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Today in the exchange, we're looking at the work before a new task force that is going to spend the next month or so considering options for tackling the state's drug abuse problem, which has claimed more than 500 lives in the last 2 years. As we're hearing, the goal is to craft legislation quickly in time for the January return of the legislature. What do you think the first priority of this task force should be? Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Tim, I'd love to hear from you, too. What do you think is the most important piece of this? I know it's hard to pick out one, but just give us one or two.
Well, and I think recognizing that the idea of a package of all of these changes at once is probably what can lead to the most impact. But I think to a fair degree, and it's actually an issue that touches a number of the policies to be debated, which is one of fiscal policy and financial investment. You know, going back to Representative Rosenwald's comments around the health protection program, you know, people need treatment and recovery supports. And there has been an increase in funding from the in the new budget year, and those dollars are currently in the process of being expended. But I think we recognize that ultimately, in addition to certainly some of the criminal reforms and penalties on the prevention side of it to hopefully deter, we also need to make sure that those who are ill can get access to the assistance that they need as quickly as humanly possible. That may be medically assisted treatment for some, that may be inpatient or outpatient stays, community-based recovery supports, and those require financial investments. There's also a bill that's being talked about in terms of drug courts that would look at some investments so that the state shares in some of the drug court expenditures. So I think it's not a singular issue in terms of financing, but I think it touches a lot of the issues that are going to be discussed, because I think without a real serious conversation around increased investments, it's going to be difficult to pull off some of those key things that are going to be needed if we want to see the rates drop and start to see more people in treatment.
So coverage for recovery and treatment, tougher penalties for distribution of fentanyl. How about you, Senator Bradley? Most important, if you want to pull one out.
You know, I think there are three things that really we should be talking about. I agree with Representative Rosenwald about the need to reauthorize Medicaid expansion. It's working to keep health insurance costs lower in New Hampshire, so that's one good positive about it. But in the second quarter of this year alone, 1,700 people accessed the substance abuse benefit under Medicaid expansion. So that tells you exactly what Tim said, that it's very important for treating long-term recovery. Senator Booten and I have sponsored the drug court legislation. So that will help people that are addicted to, you know, substances that are illegal to avoid jail if they take personal responsibility and go through the drug court process. That will cost some money, but I think that that's a very necessary tool, too. And lastly, I think we need to do everything we can on the law enforcement side to interdict the supply of heroin and fentanyl coming, you know, into our state. Senator Forrester has a bill. The task force will be looking at the issues raised in her bill. So I think that three-pronged approach, Medicaid expansion, drug courts, and recovery and treatment, and then interdiction.
Gary Reno, can you comment on some of these issues that our guests have brought up that the task force is going to be looking at? Which ones might be pretty easy to get through, and which ones, as Representative Rosenwald put it, are more multifaceted? That was a good way to say complicated and perhaps difficult. Go ahead, Gary.
Well, I think the one that she mentioned, the fentanyl, upping the penalties for fentanyl so that the same for heroin will be a fairly quick one. Another one is the sort of standardizing treatment reauthorization from insurance companies. That shouldn't be too much of a problem. I think where we're going to see problems are in the prescription rules, where the governor made one proposal, which was largely rejected by the Board of Medicine. And we're going to see, I think, a whole lot of discussion over who should be able to prescribe these and how much, et cetera, those sort of issues. I think another problem is going to be the pain clinics, because the governor would like to look at relicensing these and re-regulating, if you will, upping the requirements for those sort of situations. I think those are two big problems that we're going to see that are going to take some time to resolve.
All right, lots to dive into, but let's bring our listeners into the conversation. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Mike is joining us from Manchester. Hi, Mike. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how's it going?
Fine.
I made it through 7 years of daily addiction, came out last handful of months ago. What everyone's trying to do is good, but it's not going to have any effects. The addiction is just, I mean, it will have some, but the amount of money that Manchester spends every year to go after these low-level dealers is absolutely ridiculous. To spend 10 months and God knows how many hours to go after people and then wind up with a quarter ounce of heroin at the end of the day, that $1 million can definitely go towards treatment centers.
So
go
ahead, Mike. I'm sorry to interrupt you. What do you think would make a difference then?
I think it does have to be multifaceted, but education, but not education where, you know, someone like me comes in, they're looking good, everything's great, and they tell a bunch of kids how bad it was. No one listens to that, or very few. I didn't in high school. And I don't know how it could be done. Maybe the only way would be going to the jails. I'm sure there's privacy rights issues. But if they could show two things, video of people, or what, maybe actors or something, but going through active addiction, also showing people going through withdrawals, no one can understand the pain of that. And that's why increasing penalties for fentanyl and all that stuff, all that's going to do is clog up the jails. I mean, really, at the end of the day, the demand is too great. If you want to go after large-level dealers, definitely. But to bust some guy that has 5 grams on him and say it was a win that costs $400,000 by the time the attorneys get done is a blatant waste of money.
Well, Mike,
definitely need more treatment centers.
Thank you so much for calling, and congratulations on your recovery. That's terrific. I'm really glad you called in, and we should definitely talk about this in just a moment, the idea of working on the demand side, prevention. And Tim Rourke, I saw you nodding your head, so I'll go to you first, but want to hear from everyone. The exchange number for you to join us like Mike did, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, a new task force is considering options for this tackling the state's drug problem. The goal is to craft legislation quickly in time for the January return of the legislature. This hour, we're getting some of the details on what this task force might do. And let's hear from you. What do you want the first priority for this group to be? Give us a call with your thoughts, questions, comments, 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page. Find us on Twitter. Again, the phone number, 1-800-892-6477. And Tim Rourke, Cindy Rosenwald, Gary Reno, Jeb Bradley, all of you, we will get into some more of the details that you guys raised. But let's talk about Mike's call first. It was so good to hear from him. And Tim Rourke, he was saying, look, all these efforts you're talking about, fine, but given his experience with heroin addiction, he said it's not going to work. He said you need to convince people not to do this in the first place.
Right. Well, and I think that, again, it's all about a package. You know, there is certainly a need for some focus on prevention. And I think, and I've heard it from legislators and a lot of folks engaged in this conversation, that part of what we're trying to do right now is deal with a crisis and what's immediately right in front of us. But if we really want to get ahead of it, we really have to go back into the prevention realm. So certainly from the commission's standpoint, again, going back to issues of financing, there are evidence-based prevention practices. We have a prevention system in the state of New Hampshire that, if it had more resources available, could be doing some of those evidence-based prevention services that target young people and young adults who might be to prevent them from starting in the first place.
So we do have a prevention system? I didn't
we
even
do.
Know that.
We do, yes. So the state has a public health network system. There are 13 regional public health networks. Each one has a dedicated staff person whose full-time job is to coordinate substance abuse prevention initiatives within those various regions of the state. Each region has a strategic plan. They get some joint funding from the Department of Health and Human Services and the Charitable Foundation. And certainly, I think, again, if there were additional resources at the commission's purview, we would certainly make further investments there. The other thing, though, is I do think that some of the package of bills and issues to be discussed through this special task force and into next year do include some other important prevention measures, such as prescriber training and restrictions around opiate prescribing, to make sure that patients who authentically need it get it, but get it with the right education around the risks associated with it, as well as further improvements to the prescription drug monitoring program that was discussed earlier, to make sure that that system is more robust, working more efficiently so that we have more physicians using it. Those are also prevention strategies, and it's important that that is understood. This isn't all about a law enforcement response or all about a medical response, but about a comprehensive response to really show the difference we need to make.
Is that how, Representative Rosenwald, people are still getting addicted, through first getting a prescription from the doc and then realizing once the prescription is over they can't live without it?
Well, 80% of heroin users start with prescription drugs.
Legally or illegally?
Well, both. So it might be when they're prescribed legally from an injury or a surgery. It might be one they find at home, a friend gives it to them. 80% start with that. New Hampshire is a complete outlier in terms of the high opioid prescriptions that are being written in our state. We are number 7 when it comes to more than 100 morphine equivalents per day.
Wow.
And to put that in perspective, if you come into an ER with a heart attack, you might be given up to 5 milligrams of morphine in an IV. And we are ranked number 7 in the entire country.
Now, what accounts for that, Representative Rosenwald? What do you think?
I don't know, but we certainly have to have more prescriber education, and that is one of the duties of the task force. We also need a more robust prescription drug monitoring program, and we have to make sure that prescribers are using it. There is evidence from other states that when prescribers use those databases, that the rate of prescribing goes down, but also significantly goes up for patients that have real pain. So it helps prescribers, physicians, and others treat appropriately. And that's what we all want.
Love your thoughts on this too, Senator Bradley. I think one of the goals of the task force is to strengthen or require more usage of the prescription drug monitoring program. What isn't happening with this program right now that you think should happen?
Well, it's voluntary, and so you're relying on doctors to recognize that somebody is coming into, whether it's an emergency room or a pain clinic, basically trying to scam the system and get prescription for oxycodone, for instance, from multiple suppliers. So mandatory use of the prescription monitoring program may well curb that. I also think, too, that we have to be very careful when we talk about new prescriber guidelines and make sure that the voices of doctors are front and center in that discussion. Do we need to update those guidelines? Yes. But we're also one of the oldest states in terms of our per capita age, and we all know what happens as we get older. You know, our bodies start to break down a little bit more.
Yeah, your back goes out when you open the drawer to get a dish out.
People do have pain, and having watched family members, you know, in my case, my sister died in excruciating pain from her ovarian cancer. I know how important it is to have access to these, you know, type of painkillers, but at the same time, you know, responsibly used. And the last thing I think that, you know, I should have mentioned when I talked about Medicaid expansion, drug courts and interdiction is we also need to do, I think, a better job of providing for long-term recovery options. Senator Sanborn has a bill that will take a first step in that regard. I think that that goes, you know, to a lot of the good work that Tim and the Drug Commission are trying to do for treatment options. So that, you know, it has to be a multifaceted approach. No one single strategy is going to work in and of itself. But a lot of the things that have been talked about today make a lot of sense. We have to do it right. I think you're seeing from this discussion this morning that this is a nonpartisan issue. There's going to be broad agreement on a lot of these strategies. Yes, we're going to have to figure out how to pay for some of them, but we'll have to do that. And I think, you know, we're taking our responsibility seriously, as we have already, you know, to this point with more dollars in the budget and things like that.
And the Narcan bill.
And the Narcan bill, the Good Samaritan bill. And the, you know, prescription monitoring program, as Cindy well recalls, and Gary, I'm sure, and Tim, that wasn't so easy to get through the legislature 3 or 4 years ago. People were very concerned about the privacy implications.
I remember that.
Yeah, and it was fought tooth and nail by some folks that just thought it, you know, was an intrusion on people's privacy. Well, we have it now. We need to enhance it. We need to make sure that, you know, anybody that has a license to prescribe, you know, painkillers also can pass, you know, a brief examination to show that they understand what best practices are, something that, you know, Tim and Cindy have been talking about this morning. So there, you know, as I keep saying, it's a multifaceted approach. And we will get it done.
Gary, can you explain some of the issues around this prescribing practices, the Board of Medicine, the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, and why New Hampshire doesn't make this mandatory?
Well, I mean, I think we didn't make it mandatory for the very reasons that Jeb talked about, and it was very hard to get this through. So it didn't make it mandatory at the minute, but it's sort of like after 9/11, you know, there are a whole lot of things that people are willing to accept. And now that after we see that this is a crisis here, I think there are a whole lot more people are going to be willing to accept that it's mandatory, that they have to report this, and that pharmacists and physicians have to put this stuff into the database. Otherwise, it's kind of useless.
Most states make this mandatory.
Make it mandatory. Already. Most states do make it mandatory.
What about the Board of Medicine, Gary? You mentioned earlier that Governor Hassan wanted tougher prescribing practices. Mm-hmm. I guess those have to go before the Board of Medicine for approval. And the Board of Medicine said,
It's rules. I mean, it's administrative rules is basically what we're talking about. The governor made a proposal, and I mean, some of them were the amount that you could prescribe from an emergency room, for example, and things like that, which were very, very restrictive, to be honest about it, compared to what we do now. And when they went before the board, I mean, the board heard from a number of physicians saying, basically, this isn't workable. This is going to be very hard to achieve. And so but they agreed to revisit the issue and come back and report by April 1st, which is, I think, the same tied in with the task force, what they're trying to do. And it's very hard to get people to change what they're doing. And what we're really talking about is changing what people do.
Well, and as Senator Bradley mentioned with his sister, and Senator Bradley, I'm very sorry to hear about that. It's tough to tell a doctor, Gary, you know, I'm guessing doctors felt like, look, you know, politicians can't tell me how many pills to prescribe for patient A or patient B. Everybody's so different.
Well, if you're an internalist, internal medicine, for example, I mean, you're not prescribing a lot of these drugs. But if you're a surgeon something like that, you are prescribing a lot of these drugs. So, I mean, I think what the governor tried to do is sort of like this broad program, and some of these particular specialists said, wait a minute, you know, this can't apply to me because it's very different than it is for somebody else.
Senator Bradley?
Yeah, and I would add, I've co-sponsored Representative Rosenwald's bill that's going to look at this, and I think while there are some issues that are raised in that bill, what will happen with it, I believe, is that we'll have the voices of doctors and dentists and any other practitioner that has, you know, a license to prescribe at the table, so that collectively and collaboratively we'll be able to approach this issue and make sure that, you know, people that still absolutely have to have access to opioids, you know, oxycodone or Percocet, Vicodin, whatever, to relieve the debilitating pain that they're experiencing, will have it. But at the same time, that we've taken measures to ensure that, you know, these life-saving drugs that can be used inappropriately, that we've curbed that. And I think that, you know, we're touching on several different aspects of how we get there. Better use of the prescription monitoring program, better education for prescribers, better guidelines. It won't happen overnight, but all three of these strategies, I think, will help curb, you know, that part of the problem.
And we'll talk in a moment about the drug courts and expanded access to treatment. I also want to remind our listeners, you can join us, 1-800-892-6477, email exchange at nhpr.org. Today in The Exchange, a new task force will spend the next few weeks considering options for tackling the state's drug problem, which has claimed more than 500 lives in the last 2 years. We're hearing about some of those ideas, and we'd love to hear from you. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Our guests are Jeb Bradley, Senate Majority Leader, Republican from Wolfboro, a member of this joint task force, along with another member, Cindy Rosenwald, Democratic State Representative from Nashua, and the Deputy Democratic Leader in the House. Also with us, Gary Reno, State House reporter for the New Hampshire Union Leader in Sunday News, and Tim Rourke, chair of the Governor's Commission on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Prevention, Treatment, and Recovery. Again, the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Here's an email I'd like to throw to you, Tim. This is from Ron in Manchester. He says, the studies show that drug addiction isn't even due to the drugs per se. People who live in supportive communities with rich interpersonal relationships who try drugs like heroin tend not to get addicted. Ron says, if it was the drugs that directly cause addiction, anybody leaving the hospital after surgery would be an addict. The people who become heroin addicts are people who are socially isolated, depressed, or suffering from mental illness. If you're serious about reducing drug addiction, address the social issues that push people to start. Ron, thank you so much for the email. And Tim, let's pick up on a couple of the points he makes there.
Sure.
What do you think? First of all, if it was the drugs that directly cause addiction, anybody leaving the hospital after surgery would be an addict. What do you think about that? We're focusing too much on this, you know, prescription drug issue.
Right. So it's important to remember that substance use disorders are a complex illness, very much like cancer, to the extent that there isn't one reason why somebody gets it. So it is a mix of both biological makeup of your body in terms of how your body responds when you ingest a foreign substance, the influence of your environment and the social connectedness that you may or may not have, as well as trauma and a host of other issues. So there certainly are instances where there are people who can, quote unquote, use recreationally or attempt or try to use and don't develop a full-on disorder. And then for others, they do. The challenge with addiction is that there is no blood test or genetic screen that we could give an individual that could say, if you were to pick up an opiate, you would become addicted. If you were to pick up an opiate, you would not. All of us, given the nature of how opiates work, anybody who were to overtake an opiate medication has the risk of becoming addicted, regardless of the quality of their life. And I think that's really important. People who struggle with this disorder aren't necessarily those who are who might have a mental illness or who might have trauma or unfortunate other circumstances in their life, although that is certainly the case for some. I think this disease can strike anybody, and there's not one clear reason why. And I think that's partially why because if there was one clear reason, we would have found one clear cure. And there isn't one for this. There's multiple factors that go into whether or not someone might become someone with a substance use disorder, as well as there are multiple things that would need to be done to get that person well.
I have heard from other listeners, too. Thank you, Ron, for the email. When we've done similar shows, Tim, people who question the idea that this can happen to anybody, that it tends to hit people who struggle with other issues as well, social isolation, mental illness, and so forth. You're saying not so.
I mean, certainly to the extent that there is what we call co-occurrence. There are a large number of folks who have both a mental illness and a substance use disorder. But I think as we've seen in this particular epidemic that we're facing right now, this is happening to, quote unquote, everybody. And I think that's one of the reasons why this moment for us as a state is so different, because I don't think we can consider addiction in the abstract. It was easy to sort of, as a society, write it off to a certain subset of people. But now, as the recovery community is speaking out, as families are speaking out, we are hearing more and more about, that well-performing high school football player who had a shoulder injury and was prescribed an opiate. Great grades, great social network, great family, all the traditional attributes of safety and security, and they still develop that disorder. So I think we can no longer consider it limited to a small subset of people who might have some other condition that we could point to and say, this is why they got it and that person didn't.
Gary, do you want to jump in there?
Well, I just wanted to say that a while ago I was talking to Don Shumway, who was the former Health and Human Services Commissioner here. He now is at Crotchet Mountain and is retiring. And we were talking about this issue, and I said, was it such a big issue, such a tie-in between mental health and drug addiction back when you were in charge of the Division of Mental Health and Development with Disabled? And he said, oh, yes, it certainly was. He said it was much less mentioned than it is now, but it certainly was very much tied into the whole situation. And he said, when they decentralized the whole program with the New Hampshire Hospital and moved a lot of the treatment out into the communities, he said, we always used to have a staff member riding around with the Manchester police every Friday and Saturday night.
Really?
Just because of the tie-in between the drugs and the mental illness.
Interesting. And, I don't want to belabor this point, Representative Rosenwald, on, why people start. And Tim very ably described, how some people get addicted. But I have heard lots of stories that are outside of this, sort of he or she was prescribed and then he or she got addicted. I've heard plenty of just regular old scary stories about, my son or daughter got caught up with the wrong crowd and started doing heroin and didn't have anything to do with, a shoulder injury or so forth. I wonder what you think.
Well, so my son graduated from college in 2009. He went to Columbia University in New York. Great school.
Sure.
He said to me, oh, I knew some kids who were using heroin. And I said, oh, no.
Columbia is the creme de la creme, right?
Right. You didn't. I don't believe you. And he said, yes, it's true, I did. And I think he must have been right. But it was so shocking to me that someone so smart could make
such a terrible choice. We will talk more in just a moment, and we'll take a lot of your calls, so stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. This hour, a new State House task force on opioid addiction hopes to craft legislation in time for January. What do you think this group should do first? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. And Senator Bradley, Representative Rosenwald, Gary Reno, Tim Rourke, right back to our listeners. And let's go to Scott next. He's calling from Freedom. Hi, Scott. Go ahead. You're in The Exchange. Welcome.
Yeah. I wanted to say we just had a conversation that I've been listening to that says 80% of these people start by using pills. And I think that if you have a company, let's say whoever, DuPont, whoever. Oh, hello.
Yeah, go ahead. You're still in the air, Scott.
Oh, sorry. DuPont, whoever. You sell a million pills in New Hampshire. New Hampshire has to pay $1 million for drug addiction. That means you got to give us a buck extra per pill because, you know, the public has nothing to do with this. You make, you know, $20 million in profit. Does anybody even look at this type of thing?
The responsibility of the drug manufacturers, Scott, you're saying?
Yeah, because, I mean, they make millions and billions. We're not even having a conversation about DuPont or anybody like that.
Well, and the FDA and whether they've done due diligence.
The people that make dollars. It's that simple.
Well, Scott, thank you for calling in. And Senator Bradley, has anybody even looked at, you know, the drug companies, whether the FDA has approved these drugs and maybe they're too powerful? I just wonder what you think about Scott's call. I've heard other people say this.
Well, all of these prescriptions that people take for debilitating pain have been legally approved by the FDA through a long, comprehensive process. The FDA process in the United States for bringing a drug through the clinical trials and all the R&D in that is much more extensive than anywhere else in the world. So, you know, there's still no question that, as I was saying before, we need to look at prescriber guidelines to make sure that people are able to have access to the prescriptions that they need to control the pain that they may be experiencing in their life, but at the same time being aware that they can, for some people, lead to problems down the road of addiction that we need to try to stem before it gets too far. Don't, you know, when somebody comes into an emergency room with debilitating kidney stones, it's like, don't send them away with an aspirin. Okay,
yeah.
You need to give people the kind of relief that they need, but at the same time, people have to better understand the longer-term implications of taking some of these
people
drugs.
Meaning the prescribers.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
As well as the patient. I think, you know, I mean, for instance, I remember I had my wisdom teeth out a few years ago, and, you know, I was offered a prescription, and I said, you know, I'll take the piece of paper and fill it if I need it, but let me start with Tylenol. And I did, and it was okay. But it was because I knew that there could be long-term addiction problems. Not everybody knows that. So opioid treatment agreements is another aspect of the problem, so that the actual patient, you know, is getting a bit of an education before he or she, you know, goes down the road of starting to take these, you know, very powerful, and they can be addictive drugs. But at the same time, people need them oftentimes to manage the conditions that they're confronted with in their own life.
Yeah, Scott, thank you for the call. Tim, I can see you want to jump in, and Gary, you too.
I was just going to say, you know, the United States consumes approximately 80% of the world's OxyContin. So,
what does that say to you, Tim?
Well, that is the question.
Are we in much more pain than everybody else?
I think that is the question. I say it because although I'm unsure if this task force will look at issues from the pharmaceutical company responsibility side of this, which is what I think the caller was suggesting, that is part of this global conversation. I mean, in addition to rates of use, what is the role of pharmaceutical companies? You know, the FDA got some flack several months ago for approving OxyContin for use among minors. Full disclosure, I have a minor who is a cancer survivor, so I've dealt with pediatric pain management and certainly see a value add in that. But I think there is a question around the extent to which we have begun to so aggressively market and normalize the use of prescription drugs to solve all your problems? And where is there the responsibility in that? So I don't know, again, whether this would be an issue specific for this task force, but I do want to validate that certainly in the ether, this is a question, because I think while there may be some factors in terms of there are people who need authentic access to those medications for the very reasons that Senator Bradley spoke about so eloquently. And we want to make sure not to create any undue burdens on those individuals. Yet at the same token, what is it about our country where we are consuming so much pain medication in the country? Is there something that pharmaceutical companies should be doing or not that has either contributed or could help actually stave off what has become quote-unquote sort of the normalization of seeking, you know, talk to your doctor about. It's no longer just the doctor, the physician being able to make the decision in the best case of their patient. We have educated patients to be aggressive in making requests for things, for medications. And does that play a role in this? It probably does to some point. Again, it may be a bigger conversation than this task force or just here in New Hampshire. I think it's a part of the national discussion
on
this epidemic.
Prescription advertising.
Sure.
And I was at the gym the other day and the TV was on and the volume was down, but there was this little green pill that kept showing up on the screen, and the life that this woman had who took this little green pill, I thought, wow. I mean, it was amazing. You know, she had this beautiful boyfriend and she's going to fancy parties and she looks fantastic and she's always smiling and she's beautiful. And I thought, okay, what's in that green pill? Yeah. Right?
And I think as well, you know, there are, with some of the opiates, pharmaceutical companies have been working to make them less prone to to being misused. You know, so they're not crushable, they're not snortable, things of that nature. We have over time seen some of those preventative formularies not end up working out. The users or the abusers find a way to circumvent
that. Sure, people are clever, and addicts will find a way.
Right. So there are productive roles. I don't mean to throw pharmaceutical companies entirely under the bus. I think there are things that they are trying to do to mitigate it. But I do think there is this question about use in our country that we need to address.
Wow, Scott. So big question. Again, thanks for the call. Gary.
Well, just to answer some of this whole issue about the responsibility, the attorney general about a couple of weeks ago announced an investigation into some of these companies, particularly the one that produces OxyContin, and basically claiming that they downplay the addictive nature of it when they're marketing them and all the upside but never any of the downside when they're doing it. It's not the first one. There have been a number of cases like this throughout the country, and it's a mixed bag. Some have been successful, some haven't.
All right. Well, the exchange number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Jerry joins us from Epping. Hi, Jerry. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi, Laura. I have a question for your panel. If we're losing one New Hampshire resident per day to this drug problem, that means we're going to lose somewhere between 40 to 60 people by the time the legislature takes any action. So how is the legislature going to justify that inaction to the families of those people that are alive today who will not be alive by the time they get around to doing something?
Wow. Jerry, thank you for calling. And he puts it in pretty stark terms, Representative Rosenwald, and you were the one who came out with those numbers earlier. So go ahead.
Well,
upset about the delay.
We are accountable to the people of New Hampshire to get this done quickly. There's no question that we have seen a spike over the last few years. We've seen this problem coming. There has not been as much quick action as I think there should be, as my caucus thinks there should be, as Governor Hassan thinks there should be. But I'm very hopeful that early in January, the legislature will act on a much faster timeline than we typically do. So I don't think we're going to be dragging our heels until June in the normal legislative process. I believe that we will act in January on some of these measures. Some of them will take a little longer. The bill that I filed that Jeb has co-sponsored will take a little bit longer because it involves lots of different prescribers, lots of different policy areas. But the task force, I think, is accountable to the voters and the non-voters of New Hampshire to really get it done quickly, because we are conscious of the fact that we're losing our people.
Thank you so much for the call, Jerry. And, you know, Tim, we've talked about this 100 times, but I want to ask you again. Drug treatment, you've often said that the best time for people to get treatment is right at that moment of crisis. They've had an overdose, they come back, or they've had an arrest, and they realize, which way is my life going? How available now is treatment here in New Hampshire? We've heard about increasing resources, but what about right now?
Treatment access is actually getting better. I wish I could say we've solved that problem. I don't think we can, and I think it's going to be a long, slow build. But a couple of things have happened over the last few months and 6 months, I think, that are quite positive. We have seen Farnham Center is expanding their facility up in Franklin to provide expanded treatment services, and there's been a lot of attention to that. Alex Ray, the owner of the Common Man, created a challenge opportunity. Lots of people gave to that, to see that center open. We have seen a number of other treatment centers open in the state of New Hampshire, largely not public nonprofits, but private companies that have decided to come in. And again, I think with better access to insurance reimbursement, it creates the proper incentives for people to grow capacity in our state. Our treatment locator, nhtreatment.org, is growing in terms of the number of professional clinicians who are registered there saying I can provide services, so people should be looking there. And then the last thing I should say is we have begun to see a growth in recovery supports as well, which is, again, the idea of, for folks who have who needed clinical treatment and have completed it, or for folks who may have a disorder but they don't need clinical services, they just need those community supports. We have seen the growth of the Serenity Center in Keene, Hope for New Hampshire Recovery, and Manchester has seen about 1,500 unduplicated individuals since they opened their recovery center in June, and they are expanding to a new facility as we speak. There's a recovery center movement beginning to work in Portsmouth and Dover as well. And 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago now, the Commission on Substance Abuse made funding allocations of the new resources that we were given by the legislature in the last budget conversation, and are beginning to move some resources specific to expanded recovery support services into the community over the next few months. Certainly, there is more to be done and more help could be given to make that happen faster. But I do think there has been some progress in making treatment more available.
So, Senator Bradley, you talked about drug courts earlier. And again, one of the things that most people like about these drug courts is someone comes in and they say, OK, if you don't send me to jail, I promise to sign up for this, you know, strict regime of treatment, recovery and so forth. So when that person goes in, and there are some drug courts up and running already in New Hampshire, as you know, is treatment ready and available for him or her when they sign on that dotted line and say, yeah, I'm ready?
Well, as Tim just indicated, I think the recovery options are expanding. I mean, tomorrow the task force is going to hear from Melissa Cruz, who is the president of Hope for New Hampshire Recovery, about the great job that they're doing in New Hampshire. And I think that the combination of better opportunities for recovery, as well as the self-help, personal responsibility, however you want to call it, for drug courts to keep people out of jail, the recidivism rate of people that go through drug courts is far, far lower, much better than if you come out of jail. I think drug courts are successful. I think you'll see the legislature move on drug courts fairly early next year, maybe not by the middle of January, but certainly early. I think that some of the things that you will see us move on expeditiously are increasing the penalties for fentanyl, for better use of the prescription monitoring program, for education standards for physicians and other prescribers, for the insurance streamlining. Those are things that I think will be done pretty quickly in January. Things like drug courts, long-term recovery, better law enforcement efforts, those take some money. So we need to see where this budget—
That was going to be my next question, Senator Bradley, yeah.
You know, the budget of fiscal 15 is absolutely closed, so that we know where we are in terms of allocating new dollars. But I think, you know, you should have us back on, you know, not maybe right after Christmas, and by the way, happy Thanksgiving to all your listeners, but have this panel back on, you know, the end of February and early March, because I think that you will see a lot of positive action combined with the new dollars that are out there in the budget. Remember, we increased funding for substance abuse by $18 million, 75% in this budget. Those dollars, as Tim indicated, are now being allocated. They're going into recovery options. So while this is a terrible, terrible crisis, and we all know people that have been impacted, the legislature, on a nonpartisan basis, is reacting to it. We have, and we will continue to do so.
Governor Hassan has said that some treatment providers, Senator Bradley, want to come into New Hampshire, but they don't want to come in until they're sure that Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act is a settled affair. She says that's holding back our efforts to provide treatment.
That may well be, and as I think I've indicated already on this show and many other times before, Medicaid expansion is working. I mean, low-income people for the first time ever have had access to health insurance that fell through the cracks of Obamacare and traditional Medicaid. And so an awful lot of people, 44,000 people, now have access to health insurance. As I said before, it's providing a break on health care, health insurance cost increases for New Hampshire employers. That's a good thing. It's also providing treatment for substance abuse disorder problems. So I hope that early in the 2016 session that we are able to reauthorize Medicaid expansion. It's going to be an effort. There are people that still have a lot of unresolved questions. We need to answer those questions and move forward with it, because it is very important to the substance abuse problem. But it's also important to the New Hampshire economy. I have to stress that. Businesses are benefiting, and they'll be some of the strongest supporters, I hope, of the reauthorization.
All right. And Gary Reno, last question to you. What are you going to be looking at, sort of ABC, when this task force gets going and when the legislature opens in January? It's hard to say this, but January is not that far away.
No, it's not. It really isn't. Well, Jeb the other day said, you know, our reputations are on the line, and I think that's really true. We're going to see what's going to happen. Let's see what's the cooperation. Let's see what's happening. As Jeb said, there'll be a few quick things, but I think the issue is going to be, how do we deal with these that aren't quite so broad-based support, and how do we work those out?
And how quickly
can
we do that,
given
the seriousness of this issue? Thank you all so much for being here. I really, really appreciate it. Senator Bradley, thank you very much.
Thank you, Laura. Have a great Thanksgiving to you and all your listeners.
Thank you. And Cindy Rosenwald, good to see you. Thank you also, Representative Rosenwald.
Thank you, and happy Thanksgiving.
Tim Rourke, always a pleasure. Thank you for being
here. Likewise. Thank you very much.
And Gary Reno, thanks for helping us out.
You're welcome, Laura.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.